Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Quite a storm we all survived last night or early this morning. I imagine some people in city and county governments around the area will be dealing with the aftermath of all that rain and tumult today. We're also encountering the flood of students arriving on ISU campus after a summer away. And our first story of the day has everything to do with this annual ebb and flow of population. August 1st is the traditional season for the changing of the leases, when students or their subletters move out of apartments, making way for the next year's arrivals. This process leaves a lot of curbside castaways. In the context of this August's weather, you might call it flotsam and jetsam. This year, the City of Ames and Iowa State University's Office of Sustainability came up with a strategy to address this pattern of waste. Mary Rankin, Director of Sustainability for Iowa State University and also Sustainability Coordinator for the city, joins us today and has brought a guest along to talk about our community's first ever Rummage Rampage event. Welcome, Mary. Good to see you again.
It's wonderful to be here, Greta. And sitting next to me right now is Bill Schmidt. Bill Schmidt is with the City of Ames, and he is the superintendent for our resource recovery plant here in the community. And Bill, tell us a little bit more about what you do, because I am not doing it justice, I know.
Certainly, no problem. Good morning. I'm superintendent resource recovery. I'm responsible for the facility where we bring all of the municipal solid waste from Story County into our facility. We process it. We separate out metals, the ferrous metal, the non-ferrous metal. We take those and sell them back into the secondary metal market where they're reclaimed. Then we grind up the rest of the material, and we separate out the burnable portion from the non-burnable portion. The burnable portion is sent over to the power plant, and about 10% of the energy that the power plant generates comes from the waste that people throw away. We're able to divert between 65 and 75% of the weight that is thrown away into trash can and keep that out of the landfill. So that's our main thing that we're trying to do, is divert material from landfill and find a good reuse for other materials.
And this was a fairly cutting-edge technology when it was first instituted, was it not?
That is correct. We're the oldest municipally owned waste energy plant in the United States. We celebrated our 40th anniversary last year, so we're going on our 41st year of it. We were in place and practicing this long before curbside recycling and recycling was even talked about. It was a very forward-looking idea back in that time frame, and it's still currently used. There was just a brand new facility put into service in West Palm Beach, Florida last year, so it's something that continues to grow and is improved upon.
And did those folks visit you to see how you do it?
They have been through, and they talked about us before. They actually had a tour down there 3 years ago, and the first line in their tour brochure was talking about Ames, Iowa, and how it was first in the nation with the resource recovery.
Well, you're here today not to talk about the technology, but to talk about the Rummage Rampage event that happened around August 1st, the changing of the leases a couple weekends ago. It involved several area nonprofits, including KHOI. Now that you've had a chance to assess the process, and we're going to hear all about it, but I think maybe not all of our listeners were clued in and knew what the Rummage Rampage was. So what the heck is the Rummage Rampage? It sounds kind of like a child's book, a children's story. Now let the wild rumpus begin.
Exactly. Well, in some cases, it was kind of like that, actually. So this event, actually, we got inspiration for this event from the City of Iowa City. They have done this for a number of years. And what they have done is recognize this challenge that they have in their community of all the curbside castaways, as you mentioned, during the changes of the leases, and said, gosh, you know, there are really wonderful usable items here, and they're getting otherwise, you know, put into the landfill. And so what could we do in order to reconnect usable items with homes and individuals and families that could use them. And so they started doing this big, they call it rummage in the ramp in Iowa City, basically a big rummage sale in their parking ramp, an area that is easily accessible, driving in, driving out for people to shop and right in the center of their community. And so we decided, hey, let's see if that's a good fit for our community. Gave it a little different name. We think ours is more clever, I think. Certainly more interactive and intriguing to get people there. But so basically what this event was that during over the course of 5 days, we accepted donations of items that folks would no longer need and then offered them for sale. It was as easy as that, as it sounds. We had items, and we focused this year, although the city of Iowa City really focuses on everything, we decided we were going to have a little smaller sales item list. And so we focused very much on furniture, kitchenware, those sorts of things. We did get some other items in and some really unique items we can talk about in a little bit, but we focused primarily on the sofas, the dining room sets, the bookshelves, the desks, the chairs, the recliners, and kitchenwares, pots, pans, those sorts of pieces, and small appliances that folks could use that were still in working order.
Well, Bill Schmidt, as superintendent of the Resource Recovery Plan, it makes sense to focus on the large items, I suppose.
That does. You know, those items are not very beneficial at all to our process or to create fuel for the power plant. There are some wood in some of those items, but we can't process that in a way that becomes usable fuel for the power plant. Those larger items have a lot of springs in them. Those springs have a tendency of getting wound up together and getting caught on other things, and they get caught in our equipment, cause downtime, cause problems. This is a time of year where we see increased tonnage with the turnover, so we try to be as efficient as we can. If those items do come into our facility, mattresses, couches, stuff like that, they end up going directly to the landfill. So if we can divert those and find a good, useful home for them, there are a lot of items that we get in this time of year that are almost virtually brand new. The people are moving out of their apartment, leaving town, and they don't have a way to haul it, so they just throw it away. And if we can find a home for those usable items, that's fantastic to keep it out of landfill and still get some more useful life out of it and preserve some natural resources.
Okay, and we have been joined by Susan Guiazda, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. You were involved in this Rummage Rampage event. Mary mentioned the name. I love the name. It took me actually a whole day to get it. That, like,
that's part of the intrigue of the event.
Yes, good morning. Well, the name is unique. I cannot take credit for it. That came from Campus Action Association. That was their brainstorm. Of course, the Campus Town Action Association tries to promote all things Campus Town, and one of the things that they want to promote is use of the Ames Intermodal Facility, the ramp. And so one night, a brainstorming creativity session, I got an email and said, hey, what do you think of this name? We know we've been kind of using the Iowa City rummage in the ramp, but we really need our own identity. How about Rummage Rampage? And it took a while, and people are still kind of getting it, like you said, but I think it's going to stick.
Yeah. I had actually looked up Rampage, and it's a bunch of people running around uncontrollably.
Yeah.
That's the definition.
We like that.
It felt like that at times.
It did feel like that at certain
exactly.
times.
In an exciting way.
Yes. Yes.
Very good, positive way.
Well, I was a volunteer there myself, and so I dipped in a couple hours here and there on a couple of days. But, Mary, you were there for a whole day on end.
We should clarify. Mary spent the night there.
Oh,
I did.
I felt very near and dear and concerned about the items there to make sure that they did safely get to useful homes.
As opposed to unsafely.
Right. Maybe, you know, taking a little bit of a hike or walk or something. Yes.
So, why don't you talk about it from your perspective? What was it like anyway to spend the night? Were you on a cot?
Well, we had to about 50 sofas there.
Oh, so. True.
It was like camping.
Exactly.
She brought her dog.
Right, right. My dog was very much on alert and excited about protecting everyone and mostly greeting everyone that would come. But, you know, we had shoppers that came through all hours of the night, actually, to browse. And before the first big sales day opened on Saturday. So we collected items on Friday, and that happened either by curbside. People could have us come and pick up items from them on the curb, and they provided a donation then that went back to our nonprofits, or people could drop off items. So the first day was all donations. So by the time it got to Friday night, we had 60 sofas.
I would say Friday's donations far surpassed expectations.
Exactly.
So we really weren't anticipating perhaps the volume or the value of the donations.
Right.
And I think that's, as a group, was something that we are addressing next year, but made us a little uncomfortable. Obviously made Mary more uncomfortable than the rest of us. And she felt that those items should be supervised overnight.
Right, right. And it allowed me to be able to really give testimony as folks came into shop to say, that one sleeps really well. This one is better for sitting for a couple of hours, that sort of thing. But no, it was pretty exciting and interesting, the fact that as we were closing up, quote unquote, for the first day after donations, getting ready for the next sales day, the number of people that were coming to browse to be ready for the items that they wanted to get the next morning. And even as I was there overnight, joined by a couple of other volunteers, I have to give a shout out to them as well. There were still individuals coming in through all hours of the evening and early morning, just sort of browsing around. And then by the time we got ready to open.
And we were very, very strict on the no early bird sales. I mean, the sale started at the time posted. So there wasn't the opportunity to come early and buy something.
No. You could just scope out what you want. And you couldn't even stage items either. And so you can imagine people were, oh my gosh, they started. Well, our very first shopper came at 6:30 and stayed until we opened at 8.
My gosh, it sounds like Black Friday.
Yeah, we used that reference many times. There was a line. Yes, that was exactly it. And we were trying, again, not expecting that kind of turnout, sort of dealing with how do we, in a orderly fashion, sort of open the doors, because the doors were open.
Right, right. And it almost felt like a Black Friday sort of door opening. But it was really interesting. Susan and I were taking money as folks would purchase things. And I remember us looking at each other and saying, oh, it's got to be about 11 o'clock. And it was 8:40. And we had sold about 75% of our inventory at that point.
Wow.
But the thing that also happened with this event is we allowed donations to continue to come in. And so for the next 4 days, it was just a constant steady stream of donations coming in and getting sold. And it would be really interesting. You know, someone would come in with a truck of donation items, and shoppers would almost crowd around the truck. And as things were being taken out of the truck, saying, how much do you want for that? You can just put it over here in my truck, or put it over here for me. I'll be back to get it. It was really fascinating experience and process to watch. And everyone was so excited about what we were doing. And I might add that, you know, these items were priced to sell and not to make money. Certainly all the proceeds went to support nonprofits, but the point was keeping usable items out of the landfill and putting them, you know, into places where they could offer use. And so, you know, our items were, we had 6 price points primarily: $1, $2, $5, $10, $20, and $25. And $25 for a sofa in really good shape is great. That's and cool. It was really appreciated
by
everyone.
Nobody blinked an eye at the pricing. And in fact, we were told by people who are more professionals in this area that we were probably underpriced. And but again, that wasn't our purpose.
Right, exactly.
Our purpose was avoiding landfilling of useful items. And I think we really achieved that purpose very well. The revenue generating was a nice side effect. And we'll talk with the nonprofits and address that next year if they feel that there needs to be some adjustments. But again, our primary goal as a community was to get usable items back in the hands of people who needed them.
So how did you publicize the opportunity to disburden yourself of large items? You know, mostly it would be students. So, Mary, I imagine you were engaged with the student population in your role as mm-hmm. in the Office of Sustainability. How did you publicize this, and how come there was so much stuff donated?
Well, it's interesting. Well, first of all, to answer your initial question, we publicized it in a number of ways. Social media, of course, is very, very popular, very much how students connect with one another. So we did a lot of social media blasting, and certainly that came from the City of Ames as well as Iowa State. And then we did a large mass email to all students, which was very interesting because not only did it have students come in to bring donations, it had new students coming to shop or students returning coming to shop a little earlier and then, you know, having those items that then they would bring back with them. But I would also say that certainly while we targeted students, this is, you know, lease changeovers for everyone in the community. And so we had a number of individuals that weren't necessarily students that were donating items. And we had a number of individuals that said, gosh, I've had this in my basement or tucked away in this room for so long. I didn't really want to deal with the hassle of a garage sale. Wasn't sure I wanted to take it to Goodwill, but gosh, this is a really good opportunity. It gives back to our community. And yeah, we drug it out and we're bringing it to this event because this just is a really good thing for our community. So we saw a lot of those things come in as well.
Well, so why don't we talk about what the impacts were in terms of waste diversion, Bill Schmidt?
Certainly. We were able to divert over 22 tons of material from the landfill. There were over 60 couches, over 110 chairs. We had almost 120 coffee tables, dining room tables diverted from the landfill. This would be the equivalent of about 3 semi-loads of landfill diversion, which is just fantastic. It was amazing. We would look at some items and go, gee, I don't know whether that's going to sell, but it's metal. Let's go on ahead and take it, because if it doesn't sell, we can go on ahead and reclaim the metal and recycle the metal. And it may only be there for 5 minutes, and somebody said, that's just the thing I'm looking for. It was amazing.
It really was amazing.
People would literally just bring it in their truck and sit on the floor, and somebody would take it. Mm-hmm. It was wild. It was just fantastic to see that.
So how much does that represent in terms of cost to the city? I know the landfill is not even in Story County, right? It's
correct.
In Boone.
The landfill is in Boone County. For each ton of material that we receive in that we have to take to Boone County, it costs us roughly $60. So we've got that offset. It takes a lot of time for us because if it comes in on a load with other material, we have to sort the garbage with a big end loader. We have a clam bucket that we pick it up. We have to go to the other side of the building, put it in a roll-off. We then have to have one of our employees take the time to take that roll-off, hook onto it with a truck, truck it over to Boone County, come back. So, and this is our busiest time of the year, so it's very inefficient for us to do that. So this gave us an opportunity to really find a way to get more items handled in a more efficient manner, and we were able to do a lot of good with it.
And were there any employees from your division working at the event?
Certainly. I was there off and on. We had several of our employees come in on their own time and help just to make sure things were running and keep things going. It was a lot of fun. It was almost a party atmosphere at times.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Everyone was just really focused in on getting things done and getting those materials handled and taken care of.
And it really is a wonderful example of the partnership between the city and the university.
Certainly.
Yeah. I would say one of the things that really grew out of this was partnerships and collaboration, not just between the city and the university, although that was crucial, but also with all these nonprofit organizations mm-hmm. that sent
Definitely.
Volunteers. We got to meet people we don't typically work with, and they were really excited. And I really thought it was because they were generating revenue, but really that was secondary. They were really into the idea of sustainability and recycling and repurposing items. It really seemed, even for them, that the revenue generating was sort of the secondary goal. So that was fun, and it really was a fun event to work. As Bill said, we had very few paid staff at this event. Most of the city employees were on their own time, and then there was a huge group of volunteers. So it was a really well-run, high-functioning event, which is, for a first-time event, it could not have gone better.
Well, and
Oh. And say, you know, we diverted 22 tons, but the thing that I was really excited about at the end of it, we only had 320 pounds of items that were not able to either sell or reclaim through other recycling means. So I thought that was fantastic.
That's a very small truckload.
It's a very small truckload. I mean, you could have fit it in a car.
Well, and some of us nonprofits benefited from the items there at the sale. I know that we got our coffee maker for $3.
Oh, fantastic.
Our $30 coffee maker had kind of conked out after only a couple months. And, you know, who wants to invest another, you know, big chunk of change into another one? And I saw that there. Snagged it. The area animal shelters, I understand, also benefited?
Yes. Yes, a number of items. We encouraged folks if they had old bedding, blankets, those sorts of things that our area animal shelters could benefit. And my goodness, I bet we had 10 garbage bags at least full of materials that came in for them. As well as folks were moving out, if they had non-perishable food, we encouraged them to bring that to the event as well that we could then offer to our food bank. So we tried to cover a number of bases that way.
And what were some of the unusual items you mentioned?
Well, so probably the most unique one that I saw come in was a tomato plant that was put into a bucket. It was a little wilted.
Didn't drink water.
Right. But somebody was so excited to see that. There was also some tomato cages that came in. I know they were sold as well. And we had quite a bit of athletic equipment that came in. Some Nordic tracks, if you can imagine. I know they're still out there, but we were interested to see those come in. And some person came in and said, gosh, I've got an old Nordic track at home. I can never find parts for it. And so purchased one in order to keep their Nordic track continuing to go. A couple of old weight benches that we sold and just a number of items that we thought, gosh, it'll be interesting to see if this goes. And it was gone.
Well,
it was really exciting.
There was the piano movers.
Yes, exactly.
They were
antiques, actually.
Right. Piano movers.
Upright piano movers.
Yeah. So in order to move your piano, you had these little, I don't know even what you would call them, but they were.
They sold in about the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Somebody knows what they need.
Yes.
We had a child-sized cello.
Yes.
Beautiful. It was a beautiful instrument, but it had a little bit of work it needed, and somebody snapped that one up right away. We had, I think it was a wine or beer making kit.
We did. It was a wine making kit.
Also
yes.
Sold.
Mm-hmm. That might have got used overnight. I don't know for sure.
I did not try it out, promise, when I was there.
So there was just a variety of things there were the things you'd expect, the sofas, the tables, the chairs, the dining room sets. Dining room sets were very popular.
Someone made a homemade rocker. Yeah, a double rocker,
oh,
and
double
they reversed
rocker.
It.
Oh, that was neat, yeah.
Yeah, I'd never seen anything like that before. It was really interesting.
And that went pretty quickly
as
well. We had some dog crates that went very quickly. And so, yeah, I mean, people would – and there were, it was really interesting, too, because you could tell people were sort of, you know, doing the different cleanouts and would come with carloads of stuff and say, I'm on my way to donate this to, you know, Goodwill, Salvation Army, whatever, but I wanted to stop by this event first to see if there was anything that you wanted because we just really think this is a great cause for our community. And so that was fun as well. We got some unique items out of that.
Yeah, and as far as the human interest goes, I mean, the story, you know, I was there, I can't remember, Saturday maybe, and these African students were there setting up
wonderful.
Their household.
Yes.
And it was so fun to talk to them. They're like, what is this? You know, some like a popcorn popper that, you know, probably, you know, the youth today have never seen either because of this.
Because we do the microwave. Dinosaur.
Right.
But we got a lot of microwaves.
Yes.
And so it was just nice to see people really taking advantage of the opportunity to, you know, create a new home for themselves.
Well, and that's a really good point because there were, you know, bits and pieces of, you know, silverware or, you know, one or two kitchen utensils or something like that. And that particular group of students, they were, you know, piecemealing all of these different things. And when they got ready to pay and they came up, I mean, they were really very emotional about the fact that for so little, they were able to stock their home, and then they had, you know, more money for the other items that they needed to be concerned about, you know, food and gas and, you know, those sorts of things. And they were so appreciative and actually spent some time donating their time to assist with the event in show of that appreciation as well. So
wow.
It was really wonderful. We had some students and we had individuals that would come in and walk around and wouldn't find anything, but would leave a donation. and say, this is a great event. Thank you so much for doing this.
Wow.
And that really, you know, just struck a wonderful chord for all of us.
Well, Mary, every month we have these discussions.
We
and
do.
You kind of give us also not just the practical and concrete examples of sustainability, but you tie it into some of the philosophical dimensions of sustainability. Could you do that briefly for us with this sale? How did this speak to sustainability and a sustainable future for the city of Ames?
Well, most definitely. I'm happy to speak about that. So, of course, we talked about the landfill diversion. And so if you look at the three facets of sustainability, the environmental, the economic, and the social, certainly we can see the environmental. And Bill has also talked about the economic standpoint from the standpoint of cost to the city in managing these materials, but such an economic impact to all the individuals that were able to come and get items and, just not have to use some of their economic resources in order to purchase some of these items that they can now put into their home. So definitely an economic benefit to our community. And socially, just the, you know, gosh, people helping people, people giving back, making such strong connections to the community. I just sitting back and watching the interaction of students and non-students, nonprofit organizations with community members that maybe hadn't heard about the nonprofit organization, was learning new things from the nonprofits. It was just such a wonderful, strong bond that I saw and we all saw forming amongst all these different groups in our community. And I think that makes such a difference as we look at that connection to community, giving back, paying forward, and all the things that we can do to grow together and to be strong and sustainable together.
Okay, well, it sounds like you've answered my next question.
Okay, all right. We'll
which is, are we going to do this again next year?
We are. We have already had a debriefing meeting and said, yes, this is a good fit for our community, and we want to do it again.
Yeah, we, of course, that partnership with Iowa State is so crucial, and, you know, our appreciation goes out to Mark Miller and the group at the Ames Intermodal Facility. They were extremely helpful, very supportive of the event, and the entire Iowa State community has been very supportive. And so when we began our discussions of should we look at this again, Iowa State said, sure, we're in. We're in. So, yes, 2017 is definitely going to become a reality. The dates, specific dates, have not been set. But obviously, you know, it will be the end of July, beginning of August, mm-hmm. A five-day period somewhere in that, covering those 2 months. And, you know, we're looking forward to it. We think it'll come back even bigger and better.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming in today. Mary Rankin, Office of Sustainability at ISU, Susan Guiazda, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames, and Bill Schmidt, Superintendent of the Resource Recovery Plant. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio.
Buckets of rain, buckets of tears, got all them buckets coming out of my ears, buckets of moonbeams in my hand. You got all the love, honey, baby, I can stand.
Welcome back to Local Talk. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Buckets of rain, yep, we got those. Buckets of tears, well, I don't know. Got all kinds of buckets coming out of our ears, including buckets of blueberries, empty buckets, having used up our berry patch blueberries on the blueberry pies that were sold this weekend as part of our birthday party. That's right, KHOI had its first ever block party birthday, and speaking of instituting seasonal traditions, this one is going to happen again. It's always amazing for us who come in and work here every week to actually meet our listeners, and better yet, to dance with them on the streets to live music. So if you missed the block party, there are still some dandy used books at the station to pick through. Come in and make us an offer on a stack before we haul them all away to another venue that will try to find them homes. It's all about the material stream today, all about the buckets. Well, Our station manager, Ursula Rudenberg, has the story on repurposed or refurbished machinery and appliances that are part of this state fair's events. Our spring intern, Henry Corbin, clued her into this lesser-known competition at the fairgrounds every year.
One of the attractions of the Iowa State Fair is a pretty large display of antique farm tractors standing under the trees in a shady lot belonging to the FFA. It's part of the agricultural mechanics competition, and the competitors are teenagers who have restored the tractors. Two competitors, Eric and Chance, were willing to sit down with me at a picnic table and tell me about their entries.
My name is Chance Steffes. I am 16 years old. I am from outside of Nevada. I live on a little acreage. I originally bought a 3010 gas from one of my dad's friends, had it sitting back in the weeds.
A 3010 gas?
Yep.
It's a tractor?
Yes, it's a tractor. It's a big John Deere. We bought it from a guy named Grant Titus, lives in Madrid, and he bought it from a guy that used it as a feedlot, as a feeder tractor.
What does a feeder tractor do, actually?
You get a feed wagon, and you just dump a whole bunch of feed in it, and it'll mix it as you're dumping it in, and then you could go right down the feed bunks to cattle or anything that you're feeding, and it'll auger it in. It really wasn't beat up that much. It just, when we bought it, it had a blown head gasket, so we brought it back to our shop. We started taking it apart. We actually got it all out. We took it into Midwest Cylinder Head in Nevada. Tim Hadley manages it, and he let me go in for four Saturdays and take it apart one Saturday, and then they did all their surfacing and grinding and everything. And then I went in the next three Saturdays and put it all back together. Then we had to put the new clutch on it because the clutch that was originally on it was not in good shape. There's mice nests all over. Then we put it in and tried starting it. Well, it wouldn't fire and keep idling. So we found out that the gasket was bad, so we took it off. Well, when we took it off, we ruined the gasket, so we had to get a new gasket. Well, John Deere couldn't get it soon enough, so went back to Midwest Cylinder Head, and we actually made a gasket out of gasket paper. Then we got that done. We went home and put it on and fired right up, and it's been running nice ever since. Right now, it's sitting at the state fair. There's two of them sitting here. They're pretty competitive.
How do you acquire this level of technical understanding?
A bunch of my friends helped me out, actually. If I needed them, I could just ask them questions, and they would fire right back and answer me. And so they were a big help, and I could figure out what to do. I believe that I did a good job.
Do you like the tractor?
Oh, yeah. I love the tractor. It's immaculate. It turned out really good.
Would you do it again?
Yes. Now that it sits there and it's pretty, I kind of like it.
You like tractors in general?
Yes, John Deere.
My name is Eric Fievold. I'm from the Nevada FFA chapter. I live out northwest of town, and I'm here at the State Fair this year with my grandfather's Alice Chalmers WD tractor that he used for power takeoff machines. So if he had like a grain auger or something like that that needed a power takeoff from a tractor to run, he would bring the Alice out.
What again is a WD?
WD is the model of the tractor for Alice Chalmers.
And how old is it?
1950. Had some fun doing it. The biggest things that we had to do on it were fine-tune the carburetor. And then the second big part of the restoration was the manifold. And it is responsible for taking the exhaust gases out of the engine and exhausting them into the air, as well as injecting the fuel and air mixture into the combustion chambers for combustion. And then the third major part of the restoration was painting it. Have you ever talked to an old Alice guy? There's two different types of orange that Alice Chalmers used. One was called Persian 1, the other one was called Persian 2. And Persian 1, it's kind of like a dollar orange, more of a burnt orange color. And they used that up until 1962. And in 1962, they switched over to Persian 2, which is a much brighter orange, which is more comparable to like a slow-moving vehicle sign or like the bright orange T-shirts some people wear, like a construction worker. And you can definitely tell walking around the fair which color that they used. And we painted it Persian 1 because it was older than 1962.
What makes this tractor competitive here at the fair? Why did you choose it?
It's actually my late grandpa's tractor that he wanted restored. And so I was lucky enough to be able to do that for him. And then I guess what makes a tractor competitive down here at the fair, so if you did a lot of mechanical work, that usually vaults you in the judge's opinion, as well as a good paint job. I guess you could say painting your tractor the right color orange would also hopefully help you out. Yes.
So what happens to the tractor after the fair?
We'll take it back home to the farm.
It runs, right?
Yes, it runs very well.
So it can be used for farm work if you wanted to?
Yes, it, technically speaking, could be used from farm work, but nowadays the implements have gotten so big, the modern implements, that it would be really hard, almost impossible actually, because they don't have the right hookups.
Is your grandfather still alive?
No, he passed away last year.
So this is in his honor?
Yes, it is in his honor, yep.
Okay. Describe your grandfather.
Oh, my grandpa, he was a stubborn old man, but he was a great guy. He
was a farmer?
Yes, he owned a farm. He was downsizing his operation as he got older and it was harder, and there's only three tractors that he couldn't part with. One was the WD that I did, and the other two were two International 560s. Those were his three tractors that he couldn't part ways with. And so being able to do one of those three tractors really, really meant something, because he held on to that for almost all of his life and hoping a grandkid would redo it for him. So I know he's not here right now, but I know he can see it. And, I think he's smiling from ear to ear up there.
After hearing about the impressive work done by Eric and Chance, and after seeing their tractors, which were impressive, I flagged down a young man dressed in an FFA uniform. His name was Chase, and he looked very busy, but was willing to take a minute to describe the FFA to me. FFA stands for Future Farmers of America, although the organization has actually changed its official name to the National FFA Organization. This is how Chase described the FFA.
My name is Chase Kuzel, and I am currently serving as the state secretary this year for the Iowa FFA Association.
What is FFA, and why does this organization exist?
This youth organization exists mainly to promote agriculture and show all the awesome things that agriculture is doing within the world and how much we have grown.
So presumably also to help young people get into agriculture?
Yes, it's a thing to not only promote how good it is, but then get people aware so they know where the food is coming from, how agriculture works, how farming works, plant science, just get the more knowledge out there with classes about animal science, plant science, marketing, anything you can think of. And then we also have a leadership development side, kind of an in-school and out-of-school thing. So when you participate in FFA, you learn different career opportunities, leadership development skills. We have contests that improve your job interviewing, public speaking, parliamentary procedure to learn how to properly run a meeting, whether you're going to be doing that in your business, tons of different things to get you ready for your career in the future.
How does somebody get into FFA?
So you'd have to be enrolled in an agriculture class, and then you would pay a due with is a small fee, and then you would be automatically in FFA and have all the different open doors and opportunities that you would have. Some chapters have you pay the dues, some chapters pay them for you. So it just kind of depends where you're at.
And where are you from?
I'm from Benton Community, so Van Horn, Iowa, about 30 minutes west of Cedar Rapids.
And you're planning to come to Iowa State?
Yep, I will be a freshman at Iowa State this year.
Okay, well, welcome to Ames.
Thank you very much.
Inside the FFA hall, I was able to enjoy the photography exhibit and a display of woodworking competition entries, including a chess set, which was using carved farm figures such as tractors, grain silos, and pigs as characters. But I was looking for Henry Corbin from Nevada. Although Henry is only 19 years old, he is already an expert on antique machinery, and I knew he could offer some perspective on the value and social meaning of the antique machines being displayed in the competition. I caught up with him sitting at a picnic table outside the building.
This is the Agricultural Mechanics Competition through the state FFA, predominantly restoration.
We're talking with Henry Corbin. He's a collector of antique farm equipment, and he's also the agricultural tour guide at the Nevada Historical Society. And this year, you were part of the FFA competition at the Iowa State Fair.
I'm in the Ag Mechanics, which deals mainly with the tractors and equipment contest.
And this year you're not entering tractors. You're going to go a different direction. Tell us what direction you're going.
Well, I'm doing a couple projects this year. I'm restoring a 1961 Barker chainsaw, and I got that from a farm auction. A very close friend of mine, his grandfather's family farm was up for auction, and I bought this chainsaw off a hay rack, and everyone kind of gave me a strange look when I bought this old chainsaw that was covered in grease and dirt.
What power is it?
It's a little one-cylinder, two-cycle engine.
And this runs on gasoline?
Yes. Yep. Uh-huh. It runs on a mixture of an oil and gas fuel. And it's a little scary because the spark plug's right by the throttle trigger. And so I'm a little nervous about getting shocked. It'll be an experience to do it. And so I'll be showing it.
What else are you showing?
I'll also be showing a Maytag washing machine. It's an early 40s model. It works and everything. My grandfather had it, and he actually bought it because he needed something to wring out the chamois from washing his car, and he had got it in a trade for some carpentry work he did. The person he got it from had immigrated to the United States and bought it new. It's amazing that that technology still works to this day.
And why do you think this is a competitive piece of equipment?
Well, I'm going to give it my own little flair.
What does that mean?
Well, you'll see a pink tractor every now and then for breast cancer. And several years ago, I lost a great aunt, Nell, to breast cancer. And so I'm dedicating it to her. There'll be a little bit of pink in it. It'll be different.
That's not frowned upon?
It kind of depends on your judge. There's a group of usually three judges that go around and they talk to us. And I enjoy talking to the judges. And that's half of the showing is talking to them because they're regular farmers too, and they come in because they love seeing the equipment too. They'll ask you, you know, why did you do this project, and you know, what significance does it have to you? They also want to know your story.
What are you going to say?
On the washing machine, I'm going to tell them it's representing a very strong woman, a person that I looked up to. I kind of just wanted to do it to represent her and something. I think she'd enjoy it. She would have loved to have seen it at fair, and I think it's just a good way of remembering her.
So it's a memorial piece.
In some cases, I might lose points for it, but at the same time, part of me, I wouldn't say doesn't care that I would lose points over it. Part of me, I'm doing it because, you know, it's for my great aunt, you know.
So you're making a statement.
It's a statement in a way. And I thought, you know, I can have fun with that and it'll still say what I wanted it to say. And I think I'm a good competitor in that.
Talk a little bit about how the washing machine affected life on a farm when it was invented.
The farmer's life, especially in Iowa, it's not an easy one. And, you know, wherever you could find something to make your life a little easier and just a little better, you know, that would be a lifesaver, you know. I've heard stories through my grandfather and everything of before the washing machine, you know, you had your washing board and everything, and, you know, you'd have to scrub your clothes, and it was a process to it. And when you got the washing machine, I think it was a little bit of a status symbol, too. Like refrigerators and televisions, when people first got those, you know, if you had one of those, you know, you were comfortable, you had done well for yourself. And I think the washing machine stood for that. My grandfather remembers when his family first got a washing machine. It was a big deal. It was a gas engine one, but
a gas engine washing machine.
And he always told me stories about how him and his brothers would take the engine off of it. And his mom always said, it has to be back by Monday so I can do the wash, but you can use it. And so they'd stick it
what
on.
What did they use it for?
Oh, they put it on bicycles and other things, you know, make a little homemade motorcycle or something. It was something fun for them to work with, but they said it was always back Monday and it was always on the washing machine ready to go.
The power of the internal combustion engine brought into people's lives?
Oh, it was. And my grandfather's always loves telling me about it because at that time his house didn't have electricity. And so they had bought the gas model because there was no other way of powering it. And that kind of put it in perspective for me, the fact that my grandfather grew up with no electricity when he was younger. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. And he still thinks when I have this other washing machine, he still thinks it's just amazing how they had, you know, electric motors on it.
So why do you love old machines?
I should say I love them because of their stories a little bit.
Yeah.
I like what they represent because behind each one of those equipment and those tractors and the equipment that went with them is a story. You know, the man that bought that tractor or that tractor worked on their farm. And it's also interesting to see the equipment themselves and to see how they were restored, where they came from, where there was a tree growing through it or something, and this FFA member just restored it by themselves or with the help of their family sometimes, brought this worthless hunk of steel back to life and to its former glory. And it's interesting for me because I think some people don't appreciate the agricultural restorations in a way. You see a lot of restored cars and everything like that. But these tractors are kind of that way too, and the equipment too. If we don't take care of them and we don't restore these things so they're still around, you know, it's kind of it's a missing link for all of us. And those stories of it would be lost.
That's our history.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in a sense, continuity with the tradition of agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think washing machines impacted women's lives more than men's lives?
If it made it easier in the women's life, because, I mean, my grandfather's family, they were a larger family. And so I think it kind of just made my great-grandmother's life a little easier because she didn't have to hand wash all those clothes. And the time you would have to spend doing that, you know, she could just put them in the washing machine, run it and wring them out, and it would allow her to do other things that she wanted to do. And my great-grandmother, she'd be out with the cattle, you know, she was right there with them. And so it was just something you didn't have to think about anymore to to do. And I think with my grandfather and with the chamois and everything, so I think it just made everyone's lives easier.
So to some degree, the history of antique farm machinery is the history of the hard labor that farming has been and the various efforts to alleviate that hard labor in different ways, right, to assist people in the tasks that were very labor intensive.
Yes, I remember hearing stories from my grandfather. He grew up in his early years, they were still using horses to pull equipment. And he said that that leap from when you're using horses to do all your work to that tractor, it was a big jump.
How exactly did the tractor change things?
It made it so they could farm more ground. And it's a lot easier with a tractor because you don't have to feed it. You don't have vet bills. It made life simpler. It was less time that you had to spend getting ready to do the work. And also, you can work a tractor significantly harder than you can a horse. It was just a way of making their lives easier and a way of making it so they could do their jobs better. And he said he remembered the day that the new tractor they'd put in for a year or farther down the road that would make their lives easier. He said he remembers it pulling up the driveway. And when he told me that story, you could still see it. You know, it's a pride. It's a little bit of pride because it's getting that new equipment. You can see all that hard work that you went through to earn that.
And here it was coming up the driveway, the result of your investing in yourself.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of pride still to this day. And you can even hear it, you know, when he talks about it. And I've learned that from him, too, that when you work hard for something and then you get something from that, you should be proud of it because you'd put the labor in to earn that.
Well, good luck at the fair. In the competition, and what's the prize?
Best of class, and it would be for restored farm equipment. I'd love to have that.
And what do you get?
You get a ribbon, and I'm not sure. I think it's just a ribbon, maybe a prize. It sounds funny, but I'm more excited about the ribbon than anything because that's kind of a pride thing. You know, you get to put that up on your wall. But it's also the contacts that you make through it. I mean, the thing I've taken away from a lot of these fairs that I've shown in is friendships. I mean, you meet so many people, and you can just stand by your equipment all day. And
people talk to you?
Oh, it's amazing when you go down there because I've always known that, you know, there's a lot of farmers that are interested in it. But when you put all these people into a small space and we're all stuck together for, you know, seven, eight hours of the day, we all start mingling around, talking and stuff. And then there's, of course, the crowds coming in. And, oh, it can be so much fun. I mean, there's people from all around the world that are interested in it, too. And it sounds funny, but just that 7 hours that you're, you know, stuck together, you create friendships.
All right. Well, good luck at the fair.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. We're speaking with Henry Corbin, who is a collector of antique farm equipment, a connoisseur of historical farm equipment, and he's also the groundskeeper and agricultural tour guide at the Nevada Historical Society, and entering a old pink Maytag washing machine and a chainsaw in the FFA Agricultural Mechanics Competition at the Iowa State Fair. Mm-hmm. Good luck. And this is Ursula Rudenberg reporting for KHOI Community Radio from the Iowa State Fair. And to date, I have not committed any food crimes.
We're going to end the show today with a word from our Community Service Appreciation Program. Every month, reporter Kay Puttock selects a different nonprofit agency to be highlighted through interviews and public service announcements. This month's honoree is the Ames chapter of the NAACP, or the National Alliance for the Advancement of Colored People. Here's Kay Puttock speaking to one of the organization's members.
My guest is Devita Harden, who's the secretary of the NAACP, and she's come to talk about the organization, the local organization here in Ames, and what it does and what it's been involved with recently. Welcome, Devita.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, what have you been up to recently?
As far as the NAACP goes, we traditionally take the summer off where we do planning for the upcoming year. So I've been doing not a whole lot on that end for the NAACP.
Okay. And so what have you been planning?
What we're planning is continuation of the educational dialogue sessions with Ames Police Department. And what that consists of is just bringing to the forefront, to the community, how the relationship between the police department and the larger community. We did three prior sessions was on Know Your Rights. We did a role play in what can go wrong at a traffic stop. So along those lines, we're just trying to better understand the role of the police officers and for the police officers to also to understand how we as individuals in the community, how we view and how we react and respond to them. It's all about sharing of information.
Now, without spoiling everything, can you share some of the insights that will be shared at that session?
One of the things that we talked about was with so many new students at Iowa State is that we don't often understand the lines of jurisdiction. Where does ISU police officer, Ames Police Department, and Story County Sheriff's Department, where those lines of jurisdictions are? So what we want to do is to involve all those agencies together and have a panel form and to explain just where the lines of jurisdictions are from a legal and a law enforcement perspective.
Okay. Now, you mentioned traffic stops and what can go wrong with traffic stops. What immediately comes to my mind is when people are reaching in their bag or in their pocket, inside their jacket to get their driver's license. That makes the cop nervous because they could be pulling out a weapon.
From the information that we shared is that police officers are well trained on how to conduct the traffic stop. They're trained because this is part of their daily job. So, but for me, for you as a driver, and we get pulled over, everyone's nervous, and it can
escalate.
Officer can de-escalate or escalate the situation depending on what they do. So, by doing the role play, we could show what could go wrong. Everybody's attitude, and I had the pleasure of playing the angry driver. I was the angry lady driving. So, but
might not be funny if it really happened.
Correct. We've seen that. Yes, we've seen that. What can go wrong? So if my attitude is negative, his attitude is negative, and he approached me, then we have a problem. That can go wrong really, really fast. But if everyone is courteous and have mutual respect, it can go pretty smoothly. You know, again, officers are trained. We were shown how officers should approach the car in a non-threatening, non-apprehensive way. It's really
sort of slowly. They don't walk very fast, I've noticed.
Right.
They kind of stroll up.
Kind of stroll up, yeah, and they position themselves so that they can observe and for their own protection.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what happened, this is when I taught in Minnesota, what happened to a student of mine who was from Somalia? He came in, this just happened, he came into my office and told me this. He was quite shaken, actually. He'd made a U-turn in front of the bank, which I guess made them suspicious, and they stopped him. And he was, just as I was saying, reaching inside his jacket for his driver's license, and the next thing, he had a gun right at his head. And he said, you know, what's the matter? I'm just getting out my license. And they said, well, you know, they did apologize and said, well, something bad had happened to shortly before, and they were very alert, as they put it.
It goes to knowing for the individual to know their rights, and they have a right, you know, from my understanding, it's been told to me that every police department is trained, there's going to be some variation in the way they're training their policies. So I can certainly see how that could be a problem in Minnesota and other places across the nation. But as far as here in Ames, what we were shown was the way Ames Police Department is going to do it, which I do appreciate.
So they do it correctly. Yes,
yes, they did. Did it correctly. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. It's something to think about when you watch the news and you see how tragic an event can turn because someone overreacted or for other various reasons. You know, racial profiling. We know it is real. It does exist. It goes back to training.
Right. One thing that I must admit often comes to my mind, because I'm originally from England, where, as you know, cops don't, as a normal run of things, carry guns. And they're all in pretty good training. If a suspect runs away, they run after them. Now, quite honestly, you look at a lot of policemen in this country, they couldn't run after anyone. And they rely, like this guy that was shot in the back the other day, they rely on their guns to do that. So
one of the things that the NAACP does with in the Ames Police Department is to realize the importance of having a relationship, building a relationship in the community with the people in the community. And we're very, very thankful for the Ames Police Department for doing that with the NAACP. And I can't speak on how other departments are ran or the interaction, but the NAACP is very, very thankful and grateful for the opportunity to build a relationship with the police department.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out the show with our regular guest, Mary Rankin, who brings us news of sustainability issues in the community. Today, she was talking about the Rummage Rampage with City of Ames Public Relations Officer Susan Guiazda and Waste Management Director Bill Schmidt. We then heard a segment from the Iowa State Fair brought to us by reporter Ursula Rudenberg and KHOI's former intern, Henry Corbin of Nevada. Finally, Kay Puddock brought us Davita Harden of the NAACP. We will hear from the group's director or president, Edna Clinton, next week. If you know of a nonprofit whose work deserves our attention through our Community Service Appreciation Program, please let us know. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. And thanks to Ron and to our engineer Jonah DeGeest for setting up the sound for our birthday bash over the weekend. We couldn't have done it without you guys. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest, who is among the flood of new ISU students. It is his last week as Local Talk engineer, and Jonah, we're going to seriously miss you around here. You must come back. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Buckets of Rain by Bob Dylan. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.